We should mention, too, I think in 1984, you developed your own baseball scorebook.
Hmm.
And you started marketing it. So talk to us about that.
Well, when I did that first Cardinal game I told you about, I scored that game in a softball scorebook that I bought at Buck Sporting Goods at 51st and Sheridan. I didn't have a baseball scorebook. You know, I think when I did it in college, I just scribbled it on a piece of paper. I just really, kind of did my own thing. Well, after a couple of months, I'm like, hey, you're in the big leagues. There's got to be something better than a softball scorebook. Well, there was no internet. I couldn't, there was nowhere I could go find. I asked around a little bit, and I saw some different scorebooks that some of the announcers had, and I just didn't like them. So anyway, we were on the road somewhere. For some reason, I'm thinking it was in San Diego. And the Cardinals manager was Whitey Herzog. And before the game that afternoon, I said, hey, Whitey, if you don't mind, could I have a couple of blank lineup cards to take back to the hotel with me? I'm trying to design a scorebook that I can use during the games. And Whitey said, sure, reached in his desk drawer, pulled out a couple. Well, they have the lineup, but then the thing that really caught my attention is it gave room for the substitutions. It had a box at the bottom about who the extra guys were, the left-handed hitters, the right-handed hitters, the switch hitters. Then they had another box for the other team's relief pitchers, so you could match up. So those lineup cards I got from Whitey were the inspiration. I took, I think I got some blank sheets of paper from our traveling secretary, went back to the hotel that night, sat down on my desk with a ruler and a pencil, and laid out the grid, and that was the grid. It's undergone several changes over the years. So that's when I developed the book, and I only put, I think, about 60 games in that first scorebook because I was only doing 50 games. I took it to a Jiffy print place down on South Peoria, and they printed up a book and put a cardboard cover on it and some pretty lame binding, and that's how the scorebook got started. And I used that thing, made a few tweaks here and there for the better part of 10 or 11 years. And John, I would always have it under my arm when I went down to the field for batting practice. And guys would come up to me and say, hey, man, where'd you get that scorebook? I like the looks of that thing. I'd go to the back of the book. I'd tear a page out. I said, copy it front and back. Take it down to your local Jiffy print, and you'll have a scorebook. Well, that started happening enough that I started thinking, I wonder if there's a market out there for this thing. So in 1995, this is 11 years later, we designed a little brochure. I'll never forget this. Debbie and my daughter Katie and I sat in the living room one night and put these brochures together, taped them together, and then I put mailing labels on them and sent them out to every minor league team in the country. We had Baseball America put out a minor league and major league directory every year. So I had all the addresses. I sent them out. Broadcaster, Tulsa Oilers, 1500 or 4500 East Yale or East 15th Street, whatever, and sent those out. That first year, we sold 40 books. The next year, we sold 80. The year after that, we sold over 100. And then in 1997, I met a person who designed a website for the book. This was 2 years after we started, because it was mail order only. I still have that mail order box down at 81st and Yale to this day, the same place still handles my mail orders down there. There's a printer here in Tulsa who does the books for me. I think I'm one of his favorite clients because I really pay on time after I get my bill. And I'm constantly calling them. I need 100 more books. I need this. I need that. John, the whole thing was pretty organic. It just kind of grew like that. The person who designed my Twitter page back in 17, she named me at scorebook _ Bob. So to a lot of people, I became Scorebook Bob. I didn't come up with that name myself. She did. So that's been my Twitter handles for the last 9 years. But that's how it got started, John. And right now, every year, I probably have 40 or 50 minor league and college guys who use the book, women too. I've got probably about 15 people in the major leagues, maybe 20 analysts and play-by-play guys who use it. I have general managers who use it. I have scouts who use it. And it's now we sell, we had a record year last year. I think we sold about 2,200 books. We're on another record pace this year. It's my daughter's side hustle. Katie gets paid by dad to be the packer and the shipper. Oh. And it's become a little side hustle for her too, along with her other stay-at-home job.
That's great. Most widely used scorebook in the nation, as a matter of fact.
I don't know how that happened, but I guess there's a lot of it has to do with longevity, because the book's over 40 years old now. We've been marketing it for over 30 years.
Yeah. Let's talk about no-hitters, because obviously that's quite a feat. 7 no-hitters, first in 84 with the Cardinals.
I remember the day, I think it was Memorial Day, the Cardinals were playing the Montreal Expos, who had a young pitcher named David Palmer. He no-hit the Cardinals for 5 innings, and then the game got rained out. So it went into the record books as a bit of a no-hitter with an asterisk, but that was my first sort of no-hitter. And that was my first year in the big leagues. So that was kind of crazy the way that happened.
Okay, a no-hitter. Do you start talking about it? Are you afraid of jinxing it? Or how do you control that? How do you handle that?
It's a great question that I get asked a lot. There's a way to handle it. Now, one guy who will say no-hitter when a guy's got it going and he'll say it 20 times was Vin Scully. Because who's going to challenge Vin Scully? Vinny would say about the 7th inning, yeah, Fernando's got a no-hitter going. 8 more outs to the no-hitter. He gets in the 8th inning. 4 more outs for a no-hitter. He's saying it again in the 9th inning. I've heard him do it. And Vinny got away with it, but I don't think any other announcer has the guts to do it. Because if somebody gets a hit, you're the jinx. You said it. It's your fault, not the pitcher's, for giving up that hit. So, you know, there are different ways you can work around it. You know, you can say 6 hitless innings for Max Scherzer, or through 7, he's walked 2, but still, you know, who's a team you know hit? The Pirates haven't been able to hit safely against Max Scherzer. There's ways to say it.
Without saying
no-hitter. But you don't say no-hitter. I'm not a superstitious person. I think a lot of baseball superstitions are absolute nonsense. But that is one that I'm not willing to mess with, because we're talking history if a guy throws a no-hitter.
Okay, but when you know it's coming down to the final pitch, are you saying something then? This is the final pitch?
Here's the beauty of TV, John, as opposed to being on radio, because this has happened to me 6 other times. I've had 7 no-hitters total, and those 6 other times, it came down right to the end. The beauty of it is on TV, you can set up the situation. I think by then the fans know what's going on, and then you rely on your producer and your director. This is the big difference in radio and TV. Radio, you kind of have to keep on going, keep setting it up. TV, I always wanted to let, if you're watching me on TV, I want John to feel like he's in the ballpark with us. The announcer's not saying a whole lot, if anything. The crowd's going crazy. Everybody's on their feet. And then when it happens, that's when you pick out what you want to say, no-hitter, however you want to say it. And that's pretty cool. We had a game in D.C., where Max Scherzer had a perfect game with 2 outs in the 9th inning. He had a 2-strike count on the hitter, this reserve infielder named Jose Tabata. Max throws a changeup, which is an off-speed pitch that kind of bores in on the right-handed batter. Jose Tabata leans into the pitch, lets it hit his elbow. The umpire can call no pitch to say he didn't try to get out of the way. The umpire that day didn't have the guts to do that, and he let him go down to first base, and that ruins the perfect game. And on the air, we're like, he was one pitch from a perfect game. You know, this is after the fact. You don't say perfect game while it's going on. Well, the very next batter flies out to left field, and then I said he was, you know, something like, he was almost perfect, but Max Scherzer gets his no-hitter. You know, so the beauty of TV is you can lay out and you can let the crew set up that whole situation and make you, the viewer, feel like you're in the ballpark. And at those times, the announcer doesn't have to say a whole lot. And to me, that's a good thing.
We should just jump around here, because 92, 93, you were the New York Mets TV play-by-play.
I was between local jobs, because I wouldn't go back to the Cardinals until 95. I was at the Rangers until 89. So 90, 91, I just did baseball for ESPN. In 92, the Mets called me. Somebody recommended me to them. Tim McCarver, one of my boyhood heroes, who was the Cardinals catcher back in the 60s, he would take off on the weekends to go to the CBS games, and they brought me in on weekends to work with Ralph Kiner, work with Tim McCarver. So I did that for 2 years, and that's how I ended up with the Mets. And then in 1994, I was going to go back to New York, but then their broadcast thing kind of changed, and that job wasn't open. In 94, I got a chance to go to Minnesota and work for the Twins. I knew their executive producer, and one of their announcers, Ted Robinson, left to go to the Giants. And he and a local guy up there named Dick Bramer would kind of split the local games. I was not expecting this call. And Tim Scanlon called me and said, hey, we want to, if you can, because you're an experienced network guy now, we don't want one guy to do all the games. We want to split up. So he said, would you be amenable to coming up here and doing 50 games for the Twins? Some on the road, some at home. I said, sure, that'd be great. You talk about a summer. I went up to Minnesota. Some nights weekends I was doing games for them. On Tuesday and Wednesday nights, I was doing ESPN baseball games. And then in July, the World Cup started. That was the 94 World Cup in the United States. And I did 10 different games at 5 different venues around the country. So I was running. Debbie took the girls to Las Vegas to see her mom for like 2 to 3 weeks because dad was going to be gone the whole time. That was a crazy summer, but that's how I ended up with the Twins in 94. And I was going to go back there in 95, but then the Cardinals called me and said, hey, Jack Buck's not going to travel anymore. We need a TV guy for the road games. What do you think? Hometown, Cardinals? So I went back to the Cardinals in 95. So the 90s were just crazy for me with all those different teams.
A bit about the Twins, because I lived up there and worked in Minneapolis for a while and so forth. And you probably heard the names of Herb Carneal.
Great radio guy, Hall of Famer. I met Herb. He was still there when I was doing the Texas Rangers in the late 80s, and we played the Twins all the time.
And Ray Scott.
One of the great NFL voices in the history. And Ray Scott, it seems like he did more Green Bay Packer and Minnesota Viking games, but he was a classic TV and radio guy. Loved Ray Scott.
But he also did basically, he did the Twins. Mm-hmm. Right.
He did.
And they were huge personalities in Minneapolis.
And Herb Carneal was one of the most down-to-earth. Mm-hmm. He was like meeting the guy next door.
Yeah.
He had no airs about him, nothing superior acting about Herb Carneal, one of the nicest men I ever met. Yeah. He and Ernie Harwell in Detroit with the Tigers might have been the two most genuinely nice guys I've ever met in baseball.